Don't test Trump today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. Vice President Mike Pence warns North Korea not to test Trump's resolve, and there's no script for what happens next.
We really haven't seen an unpredictable administration making these threats to Pyongyang. It's a good test, but it's a dangerous one.
Plus, Turks vote by a narrow margin to expand their president's powers. But questions remain.
How do we proceed when the country's clearly polarized and when all the major economic centers seem to have voted no?
And an Iranian-American finds a home in the U.S. Army.
That unity and that diversity was everything that I needed, that I had no idea that I needed.
But post-Trump, she's questioning all of that. It's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. Lots happening around the globe today, from the Boston Marathon just down the road from our studios to the ongoing tensions over North Korea's nuclear program. We'll have more on North Korea later in the show. We begin, though, with news out of Turkey. A referendum was held there yesterday with big implications for a key U.S. and NATO ally. The big winner appears to be Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Voters decided by a slim margin to expand his powers. Last night, his supporters celebrated in the streets. Opponents mostly stayed home, though some did venture out to bang pots and pans to protest the vote. Karim Fahim is in Istanbul. He's covering the story for The Washington Post. Big voter turnout, around 86%, and a victory for Erdogan, but it was a pretty close margin. Is that how it looks to you in Istanbul?
Yeah, absolutely. The yes vote, which represents President Erdogan's supporters, won with 51% of the vote. But at the same time, the referendum was defeated in three of Turkey's largest cities, which represent roughly a quarter of the country's population. There was significant resistance to this proposal.
And that was Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir?
Exactly. So a far narrower margin than I think the president and his supporters were expecting or wanted. As a result, the sort of divisive atmosphere that prevailed in the lead up to the referendum, and for a couple of years now, really, in Turkey, is still sort of very much in evidence, and people are wondering sort of what the aftermath of the vote is going to look like.
What are these new powers that will now come to the president of Turkey?
The major shift after this referendum is that Turkey shifts from a parliamentary to a presidential system, which is in itself a huge change. The role of president was almost a ceremonial role, and he becomes effectively the head of state. And so his biggest areas of influence are over the parliament and over the judiciary. And the parliament also loses much of its oversight role over the president.
Of course, this referendum comes after the attempted coup last summer, hundreds of thousands of people losing their jobs, 47,000 other people in jail post-coup attempt. Where does this leave the opposition in Turkey?
In a very weak state. You know, the opposition parties, after the result last night, quickly said that there had been irregularities. And, you know, today they've called, you know, the main opposition party has called for the cancellation of the results of the vote. But the atmosphere, the space for dissent is much, much more restricted now. And, you know, there is this sort of general sense there is a hyper-nationalism that's really evident in the country now. You know, one of the opposition parties was, you know, all but sort of eviscerated. This is the pro-Kurdish HDP party. Its co-founders have been arrested. Members have been arrested. And that party was supposed to play really sort of a critical role in opposing the referendum. And so that voice was sort of eliminated.
Remind us how critical Turkey is to the U.S. as an ally and how this referendum vote could affect that.
Turkey is a critical part. It has become an especially critical partner in the last couple of years because of the ongoing conflicts in Syria and Iraq and the fight against the Islamic State. The U.S. depends on Turkey as a military partner, and Turkey has also become one of the largest hosting countries for refugees from Syria, which is very important for the Europeans who are anxious for those refugees not to travel to Europe. So
it's a big deal.
So it's a big deal. And it's a huge shift in the way the government works in Turkey. But Turkey has been through a lot over the last century, including military coups and, you know, incredible political turmoil. So, you know, it's unclear whether this, you know, significantly changes those relationships.
Karim Fahim is the Istanbul bureau chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Zeynep Tufekci was born in Turkey and teaches at the University of North Carolina. She's a frequent guest on our program and looks at the intersection of technology and society. Tufekci says she's seeing a loud reaction to the Turkey vote from both camps on social media.
What I'm seeing is both a disappointment on the pro-government side. They're hoping for a 60% plus vote, and instead they barely squeaked by. So even though it's a win, a narrow win, it's a disappointment. And I've seen a lot of sort of soul searching and discussion saying we won but didn't really win, and what does it really mean? On the other hand, from the people who opposed the changes proposed by the referendum, I'm seeing a lot of concern and outrage. The state authority that oversees the voting at the last minute threw out a requirement that envelopes that the votes were in had to be stamped and be official. And there's a lot of concern that this last minute change that had never been done like this before opens up possibility of ballot stuffing.
What does that mean, though, in terms of, you know, when you cast your vote, does it mean that you put in an envelope and somebody signs off on it that it's been cast and sealed?
So in Turkey, the voting is done with adversarial monitoring. People from different political parties can observe the voting process. And you're supposed to go in as a single voter, and you're given an envelope that is stamped by the voting authority. So it's an official envelope. And you put your vote, you go, you vote privately, you put your vote in there, and you put the envelope in transparent glass box, actually. And in the past, that stamp on the envelope was necessity. In fact, that's what the law says. They have to be stamped one by one, because otherwise, if somebody sneaks in, you know, 10, 20, 30, 100 random envelopes, how do you tell the ones apart? Because the envelopes are very plain, and they, you know, they're the kind that you can buy from any bookstore. So that official stamp, and the stamps are highly regulated and they're supposed to be counted and all of that. In a very last minute, big surprise kind of decision, they just said, oh, they don't have to be stamped. We'll take anything as long as it's counted. And that's caused a lot of concern. And people took to social media saying, this can't hold. You can't change the counting rules in the middle of it, especially with such a huge, drastic change. And right now, what I'm seeing on social media is this constant turmoil, because people don't really know what they can do. And they're just trying to raise their voice and say that this shouldn't have happened. And they're trying to track down how many such votes might have been counted.
What are the election authorities saying in their defense?
The election authorities are just saying, we're going to let this be. So this isn't a very satisfying answer, because the law on the books clearly says that the envelopes must be stamped for them to count.
Is this kind of referendum that was decided by a simple majority, is that unprecedented in modern Turkish history?
It's unprecedented in the sense that this is the biggest change to the constitution of the country in a democratic setting. We've had coups that changed constitutions, but obviously those weren't decided by vote. That was just a military dictatorship. So since 1923, Turkey's had a parliamentary system. And all of a sudden, this is supposed to shift the country to a very heavily concentrated presidential system. That is obviously unprecedented. It's the first time that we're discussing this.
What about Turkey's relations with Europe? For so many years, Turkey was trying to gain entry to the EU, and there was a whole lot of, oh, we're going in this democratic direction. Where does this leave Turkey's relationship with Europe?
Well, the first speech that President Erdogan made after the referendum, he referred to bringing back the death penalty. And that's basically a shorthand for saying we're just going to not have talks with the EU anymore. And in fairness, this has been a long process by which a lot of people in Turkey felt like they'd never be accepted in EU anyway. And now there are lots of other reasons that a lot of people in EU think they'll never accept Turkey anyway. So I think effectively the process is dead. Nobody's called it dead yet. And President Erdogan's first speech referring to the death penalty, which would immediately suspend any possibility, is kind of a way of making it formally true like that.
But what about just the fact of Turkey's critical relationship, say, with a place like Germany over refugees? Turkey's absorbing millions of refugees. It's constantly doing this dance with Angela Merkel about not letting any more through, or that whole dance. Does it have any impact on Turkey and Germany's negotiating position with each other?
I think the world is in a moment of kicking cans down the road. Clearly, there's a huge refugee crisis because of the Syrian war, and Turkey has absorbed more refugees than any other country in the world. And for most of that few years, it has not been helped out financially, proportional to the amount of refugees it was taking it in. And it was only after the refugees started flooding into Europe through other ways, there was this deal cut. It was this unclear deal, right? It doesn't really solve the problem. It doesn't really address the crisis of having millions of people having to flee a war. So what I feel like what both Germany and Turkey are doing and the rest of the world are doing, sadly, is sort of kicking the can and not addressing either the root causes of this crisis or trying to figure out what happens. You know, this is the biggest refugee crisis in the world since World War II.
Zeynep, certainly a post-coup attempt feature of Turkey has been the complete crackdown on media, any kind of opposition media or independent media. What's the future of that? I mean, do you think that the various journalists who've been arrested are just going to stay there? Or does this codify a very kind of tough line by Erdogan and the government on freedom of speech?
What I can say is after the July 15 coup attempt, it was what remained of free media that actually helped galvanize the country against this illegitimate coup attempt. So I had hope that this would be a turning point, this recognition that a free press is essential to the healthy functioning of a society. Unfortunately, that's not what we've seen in the past year. If anything, the crackdown's gotten worse and worse and worse. We have all these cases of journalists who are now in jail, and they haven't even seen indictments yet in many cases. So it's kind of unclear what they're being accused of and why they're in jail while awaiting sentencing. So it's a really worrisome situation. And my hope is that there's a turnaround and that a free and flourishing critical press is not just healthy for a country, it's what stabilizes it. Because if you don't solve the problems you have and you kind of sweep them under the rug, they don't go away. They just sort of bubble up and then it leads to worse crises. But here we are and we shall see.
Zeynep Tufekci's new book is called Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Frailty of Networked Protest. Thanks, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
A quick look ahead now before the break. Tense times right now on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea keeps testing missiles, ballistic missiles that could be used to deliver nuclear payloads. The Trump administration's message to Pyongyang is pretty stark. If no one will stop you, the United States will. But you shouldn't expect the North Koreans to just quit their nuclear program.
The fact of the matter is that the North Koreans believe that without their nuclear weapons, we will remember them only on World Food Day. And they're probably not entirely wrong on that point. So their disincentive for giving up the weapons is extremely high.
More on that story in a few minutes. And coming up tomorrow, driverless cars. Will they help or hurt the environment? Depends on how you design them.
For example, we could invest in autonomous vehicles that are much lighter weight, could have much better drag coefficients, so they look much more like a fish instead of a block moving through the air. And all of these developments could dramatically reduce the amount of energy we use, even if we're driving very fast and very far.
We'll have more on that story right here on the show tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills with The World. President Trump came into office with strong support from veterans. Almost two-thirds of those who've served in the U.S. military voted for Trump in November, according to CNN exit polls. Of course, many veterans also happen to be refugees and immigrants, which makes for an interesting dynamic right about now. The World's Roopa Shenoy spoke with one veteran from Iran who organized one of Trump's inaugural balls.
The night of Donald Trump's inauguration, elegantly dressed people navigated around thousands of protesters to get from party to party. One of the biggest bashes was a veterans ball at an old hotel a block away from the White House.
Listen up, hold down the noise.
Spirits were high as the MCs started the night's program.
One woman in particular really moved mountains to make this event happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the chairwoman of the Vetties and the CEO and the Academy of the United States Veterans, Asal Ravandi. Please come up, Asal.
The glamorous woman who walks on stage in a sparkly black gown has a Middle Eastern name and features. From the video, you can't tell if that surprises anyone in the audience.
Tonight, I am exactly where I want to be, witnessing a historic event, regardless of your political persuasion. I was born in Iran, and I was born in the middle of a revolution that has left the country in a state of despair. I've been all over the world, and I've seen so many, many, many different types of people. From all walks of life, they come together, our nation's veterans, in one armed forces, and they fight for a great cause, and that's where I found my salvation.
Asal grew up during the Iran-Iraq War, and her childhood was full of rockets, bombs, sirens, alarms, and fear. Her family got out when she was 13, but her father died in a plane crash before they moved to the States. Asal, her mom, and her brother arrived as refugees without him. They settled in San Antonio, Texas, and Asal resolutely put violence and tragedy behind her. She was able to focus on just being American because there were no other Iranians around.
I didn't have the ties of a Middle Eastern culture pulling me back.
She joined the army in her late 20s after a short career in PR. Obama was president.
I wanted to work for him, so I thought this was my chance to be able to contribute.
Some friends thought she was crazy, but her mom was proud and supportive.
So at first, you get that whole G.I. Jane kind of thing in you. And you think that you're going to be this tough girl who's going to go out there and beat all the guys. But that ain't so.
Yeah, she got cold feet at the hotel where they met to get on buses to go to basic training.
So at that point, there's no going back. And I had to get on that bus.
She was afraid she wouldn't be as fast or strong as her fellow soldiers.
And I was right.
A few weeks into training, she left her gun on her bunk. Her drill sergeant found it and made Asal's company do sit-ups and push-ups for an hour. Then the sergeant assigned Asal an essay about safeguarding sensitive items. She had 3 days to write it with a pen and paper.
Finally, I finished the 20-page paper and I handed it to her, and she grabbed it from my hand and she threw it in the trash. And she said, "Your opinion doesn't matter." I remember that was my breaking point that night. I went back to my bunk and I cried.
It was all part of the process of being broken down and then built back up again as a soldier. Asal lived up to the challenge and arrived in Afghanistan as the only woman in a vast battalion in 2012.
I could still see snow on the mountains. I got really emotional. I had left that world once before when we left Iran. That's where all the memories just started on that day.
The whole mission in Afghanistan rested on people like Asal. She was the only translator in her unit, and she was cross-trained as an intelligence specialist.
I was a low-ranking service member who was doing the job of someone who was 3 or 4 ranks above her.
The army made Asal feel like a vital part of something larger. She was focused and had an important purpose.
That unity and that diversity was everything that I needed, that I had no idea that I needed. Sometimes I say I don't remember who I was before I was a soldier, because that defines me as a person.
But medical problems forced her to leave after one deployment. Grad school in D.C. was a letdown after the person she'd been in Afghanistan. VA doctors put her on antidepressants.
I don't think I'm out of it. I think I have learned to maintain it. I don't think you ever come out of it. Not for me, at least.
Asal found refuge with fellow veterans. She started a PR firm for veterans organizations. Her private company, the Academy of U.S. Veterans, partners with nonprofits to put on fundraisers and then splits the proceeds. The Academy also organizes an annual awards dinner called the Vetties. This year, they combined the awards with a huge inaugural gala, which is why Asal was on stage the night of Donald Trump's inauguration, even though Asal voted for Clinton.
First, I'm a soldier, and then I am anything else. So as a service member and as a veteran, I will serve any president that America elects. It was one of the most glamorous, most talked about presidential balls held in Washington, D.C. that night. We would have done the same if Hillary got elected.
But she still said things she wanted to say, like that story of her family coming from Iran.
I wanted to send a message that people like me cannot be overlooked. And the immigrant that we ban today could be a public servant or an influential member of our American community tomorrow. And we need to make sure that we safeguard those opportunities by making the right choices.
That's how Asal navigated being true to herself and the military community she sees as family on the first night of Donald Trump's presidency. It didn't stay that simple for long. 1 week later, Trump announced the first travel ban on people from, back then, 7 Muslim-majority nations. And on Facebook, Asal wrote that she was going on vacation and was scared she wouldn't be let back into the country. She wrote, "If they don't let me back in, where would they like me to go?" Dozens of people posted messages of support. Some pointed out that Asal's a citizen, so she shouldn't worry. But she was saying that Trump's new policy is flawed.
It is not a logical structure when it comes to safeguarding our national security or our borders. We should be judged based on our actions and not based on our background.
Asal thinks the people who voted for Trump, including veterans, were really voting against Hillary Clinton, and they don't necessarily support all the things Trump says.
The truth is this. At some point in life, you have to stand for something. At the end of the day, if I don't have the support of my community because of my political or social views, I will take my education, all courtesy of United States Army, and I will move on and I will create something new. That is bittersweet, but my sense of conviction will not falter.
She's hopeful that other veterans will continue to see her as a fellow veteran first. And she's gotten past an immediate fear. She went to Costa Rica for a vacation and came back and went to Europe and came back. And TSA agents never stopped her.
So I guess I'm an American.
For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Rupa also hosts Otherhood, our podcast about the emerging majority multicultural United States. The story we just heard is an excerpt from the latest episode. You can find Otherhood on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. Soap operas are popular in Turkey, and by popular demand, it seems, most female characters are mothers and housewives.
I keep telling people that if you keep writing those kind of things, they will keep continuing asking for those kind of things. So we have to change it.
Writing strong women into Turkish soaps, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A lot of eyes were fixed on North Korea over the Easter weekend. There was speculation that the North Koreans might use one of their national holidays to conduct another nuclear test. That didn't happen. The North did try to test launch a missile, but the test appeared to fail, to the relief of many observers. Still, that's not easing tensions between Washington and Pyongyang. Here's more from The World's Matthew Bell, just back from a reporting trip to South Korea.
Hours after that failed missile test by North Korea, Vice President Mike Pence arrived in South Korea, and he delivered this warning.
The era of strategic patience is over. If China is unable to deal with North Korea, the United States and our allies will.
Pence told the North Koreans not to test the resolve of President Donald Trump, and he mentioned recent American airstrikes in Syria and Afghanistan as examples of what could be in store for the regime of Kim Jong-un.
All options are on the table as we continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with the people of South Korea for the denuclearization of this peninsula and for the long-term prosperity and freedom of the people of South Korea.
Early this month, President Trump ordered an aircraft carrier strike group to head toward the Korean Peninsula. And today, Pence vowed to step up deployment of a controversial U.S. anti-missile system in South Korea called THAAD. China has criticized the move. Beijing sees THAAD as a threat to China as well as North Korea. Today, Russia also expressed its uneasiness about rising tensions in Northeast Asia. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the U.S. is on a risky course, but he added that Moscow will not tolerate any nuclear missile adventures by North Korea. In South Korea, most people seem to be taking things in stride. Tensions on the Korean Peninsula tend to rise and fall. James Kim is an expert on the U.S.-South Korean alliance, based at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul. And he says what's different right now is that Washington seems determined to find a new approach toward the North Korean leadership.
We really haven't seen an unpredictable administration making these threats to Pyongyang, to watch and see how Pyongyang responds. It's a good test, but it's a dangerous one.
North Korea sent its own warning today. In an interview with the BBC, a foreign ministry official said North Korea would respond to a U.S. attack by using nuclear weapons. Meantime, South Korea is getting ready to hold a presidential election next month. James Kim says both of the front runners have said they would take a more conciliatory line with North Korea. However,
neither candidate has suggested that they'd like to break relations with the United States.
Or fundamentally change the relationship.
Right. I think it's steady as she goes. Yes, we might see some choppy waters with the progressive administration, but it's going to take a lot more than one election in South Korea, or even for that matter in the United States, to change, I think, the relationship that's lasted for over six decades.
But Kim says many people in South Korea are feeling pretty exasperated about North Korea and its nuclear activities, and they seem to want a stronger response. There's a lot of public support for the new U.S. anti-missile system, Kim says, and the same goes for the previous South Korean president's decision to close down a jointly operated industrial park in the north.
The South Korean public in general have come out and said, a majority have come out and said, we support these more hardline measures to deal with these problems. And we will not tolerate China trying to boss us around and telling us what we can and can't do about this problem.
Still, Kim says no one in South Korea really wants to go to war, and they're hoping that increased pressure might push North Korea's young dictator, Kim Jong-un, to rethink his commitment to developing nuclear weapons. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
There are plenty of experts and officials in Washington who are concerned about how the situation with North Korea is evolving. An analysis piece in the New York Times today is titled "A Cuban Missile Crisis in Slow Motion in North Korea." David Sanger co-wrote the piece.
Well, the main comparison is the obvious one, that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy faced a set of missiles that were being placed in Cuba that could reach the United States with fairly short warning. And he had to decide, how much do you risk to stop that possibility? The differences are obvious. Those missiles were going in right in our neighborhood, and you have an extremely short response time. The superpower that was putting them in, the Soviet Union, had lots of other options of ways to go hit us. The North Koreans are obviously a long way away. They haven't proven the technology yet. You'd have more warning time. And they don't have a series of other options other than cyber, which they've used against Sony, and we've seen in some other cases, to reach inside the United States. And, of course, that usually is not considered to be something that is an existential threat. So it's an imperfect analogy, but it's an important one because it sets the tone of how a president and a presidency are viewed in facing this and other threats. And of course, many consider that to be Kennedy's finest moment.
David, I want to ask you, you know this topic really well. From your reporting and from what you know, has the U.S. ever seriously considered direct military action against North Korea?
They've considered it many, many times and always ended up rejecting it. And they've always ended up rejecting it for the same reason, that while you can understand how the United States would prevail in a war with North Korea in a matter of weeks or months, the first 24 hours would probably see the destruction of Seoul, a city of, 14 million plus. And the reason is not the nuclear program. It's that the North Koreans have traditional artillery, conventional artillery, buried away just north of the DMZ. And that distance is about the same distance as, say, Baltimore to Washington.
What's your sense of what the Trump administration is kind of willing to do in terms of dealing with North Korea? I mean, you know, military action can cover a lot of different options. Do you sense that the Trump administration is up for anything, you know, outside of kind of diplomacy and threats and, you know, tweeting?
Well, there's a big range of things. I mean, the object of the coercive methods that you're seeing now is actually to drive North Korea to a diplomatic solution. So just as in the Iran case, the economic sanctions and the sabotage were designed to drive them to the negotiating table. One would think that initially that would be the objective with North Korea as well. But it's a different situation because Iran has lots to gain. The North Koreans have almost nothing to export. They don't believe that the United States and its allies would actually integrate them with the world. They believe that they would become like Libya, which was promised a lot of economic integration in return for their decisions to give up a very nascent nuclear capability. And then the first time that the Libyan people turned against Gaddafi, the Europeans, the United States, the Arab states came in and helped them. And you saw what happened to Gaddafi. He got pulled out of a ditch and shot. So if you're Kim Jong-un and you're looking at that experience, the lesson you're emerging with is giving up your nuclear weapons is probably the dumbest thing you can do.
What other options are there for the Trump administration besides this kind of endless to-ing and fro-ing, which has been going on for decades between the U.S. and North Korea?
It has been. And frankly, if this problem was an easy one to solve, believe me, it would be solved by now. And if the Chinese could step in and solve it, they would have solved it by now. The fact of the matter is that the North Koreans believe that without their nuclear weapons, we will remember them only on World Food Day. And they're probably not entirely wrong. So their disincentive for giving up their weapons is extremely high. And we have to figure out, if you're going to come to a peaceful diplomatic solution to this, how would you actually incentivize them to go do this?
Just to be provocative, if North Korea's real interest in having nuclear weapons is for it to be a deterrent, how does that stance threaten the United States and its allies?
If alone it was a deterrent, that would be one thing. But if you listen to their rhetoric, that's not necessarily where they are. And if you look at their behavior, you'd have to say they've done some things we wouldn't predict they would go do.
Like what?
If I had told you 5 years ago that North Korea would hire a group of hackers who would come into a major studio to protest the making of a film about them and not only steal their emails or cause them some trouble, but actually melt down 70% of their computer systems, you'd probably say to me, I don't think they're going to risk it. Well, they did risk it and they got away with it.
David Sanger of the New York Times. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you.
We reported earlier on the referendum results in Turkey. By a slim margin, voters granted President Recep Tayyip Erdogan more powers. Turkey under Erdogan has become a much more conservative country than it once was, and some say that's being reflected in the way women are portrayed in Turkish TV soap operas. Turkish soaps are very popular with viewers, both inside the country and abroad. Fariha Banawa has our story from Istanbul.
This is the theme from Magnificent Century, one of Turkey's most popular soap operas. It's based on the life of the Ottoman Sultan Süleyman and his harem. The show has aired in 86 countries. In the US, you can watch it with English subtitles on Netflix. Soap operas like this have become a major Turkish export. Last year, they brought in about $300 million. In conservative countries like Afghanistan and Egypt, some men have even blamed a rising divorce rate on these shows, where female characters can walk away from abusive marriages. Tamur Savji, a producer of Magnificent Century, says Turkish serials like his feature strong women who fight back.
I see more soaps about women becoming successful, stronger, and emancipated. The soaps where there are no strong women are in the minority.
But that's not the way some Turkish women see it. They say most of the soaps make it clear that to be a good woman, you have to stay within traditional boundaries, even if it means a violent marriage.
I myself acted in a TV serial.
Elif Dadavaran appeared in a popular soap, and she says Turkey needs more female characters who don't base their identity on men, even if viewers don't like it.
I was playing the role of the very powerful woman, and I was the head of the company as the only daughter of the family. I was so happy about the role because it was like a role model. But starting after a while later, like, I don't know, the 15th episode or something like that, the role that I was playing slowly turned into a housewife, a mother.
Dadavaran says the producers told her the audience wanted her character to become more nurturing. So she quit and started producing films herself. She also directs the Antalya Film Festival.
The thing is, I keep telling people that if you keep writing those kind of things, they will keep continuing asking for those kind of things. So we have to change it. You know, we have to work on it.
Back in the late 90s, the soaps offered more diverse roles for women, says Esther Gedik, a professor of sociology of gender at Yozgat's Buzuk University. But when Turkey began exporting entertainment to more conservative Middle Eastern countries, the roles for women began to change. It's kind of ironic, Gedik says.
Middle Eastern women see this Turkish woman as more modernized, but it's not the reality, it's a picture they have.
It's not just the soaps. Since 2002, when the Islamist ruling AKP party came into power, Turkish TV has become more conservative. Alcohol and cigarettes are blurred, the word magic is censored, love scenes are cut, and divorcees and women who defy traditions are punished in the shows. They either end up in jail or raped.
So she watched this
In their basement apartment in Istanbul, Mehmet and Pınar Özçelebi sit down at night to watch Cesur ve Güzel, The Brave and the Beautiful. It's kind of like a Turkish version of Dynasty. Their kids watch too, while they play. Pınar is a stay-at-home mom and she loves the show. She says it's taught her to speak up in her marriage. And she now demands appreciation from her husband.
Tabii hani güçlü olmayı, sabretmeyi.
These women are strong and patient. We women learn how to make decisions from these shows. Men surprise women with a holiday and gifts, and I ask them to surprise me, say romantic things to me. Why am I any different? I tell them to celebrate my birthday.
Maybe that seems like a small thing, but Mehmet hints his wife might be too influenced by what she's watching.
Women aren't just sitting and waiting for their husbands anymore. They want to go out and learn about their freedoms. They learn to stand on their own.
It's a good thing, he says. Then he adds, I'm a little scared. For the world, Feribe Nawa, Istanbul.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. It's Marathon Monday here in Boston, and it was a Kenyan double this year. Edna Kiplagat won the women's race in 2 hours, 21 minutes, and 52 seconds. Kiplagat is a Kenyan police officer. She was greeted at the finish line by her children and other family members. And among the men, Kenya's Jeffrey Kirui came in first with a time of 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 37 seconds. Last year, by the way, it was another East African double at the Boston Marathon, but the top finishers then were from Ethiopia. Now, you and I might think of a marathon as the ultimate test of endurance, but we're about to meet a woman who excels at running much longer distances. Meera Rai is a former child soldier from rural Nepal. 3 years ago, she didn't know mountain trail running was a sport. Now she's one of the top long-distance, high-elevation mountain runners in the world. She's also National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year, the subject of a new documentary, and slated to appear on the cover of Outside Magazine's women's issue next month. Anne Bailey has her story.
This is Hong Kong, and this is from Somoni. Somoni Trophy.
Meera Rai pulls trophies from a glass case at her house in Kathmandu. I ask her to show me the one from her first trail running race in Nepal, the one that launched her career 3 years ago. But she says there wasn't a trophy for that race.
No trophy.
The day Rai showed up for that 50K mountain trail race outside Kathmandu, she had no idea what she was getting into.
Participant,
I went there thinking it was a training run. I didn't know it was a race. I just had a t-shirt and pants on. Other runners had backpacks and food, and I went with nothing. But I just ran and ran.
Hours later, Rai became the first and only woman to cross the finish line.
Continue.
I just continued to run, and then I didn't know, but I won.
A month later, she entered the 180K Mustang Trail race in Nepal and won again. Then she took first place in races in Hong Kong, Italy, and France. A year later, she had an endorsement deal with Salomon and became the subject of an award-winning documentary simply titled Mira. In January, she was voted National Geographic's Adventure of the Year. And she's just 29. It's not a life she imagined for herself.
Hello, good morning.
Like many rural Nepalis, Rai grew up poor. She quit school at age 12 to help support her family. She'd carry heavy bags of rice across miles of rugged trails to the local market.
The work was difficult there. The slopes were steep, so there wasn't much cultivation. For 6 months, we had food to eat, and for 6 months, we had nothing.
In the mountains all around her, a Maoist rebellion had been raging for years. Armed rebels were fighting to overthrow the Nepali monarchy and establish a people's republic. So when the Maoists came to her village in 2002 looking for recruits, Rai joined up. She was 14.
I went there not because I understood their intentions or policies, but because I wanted to do something.
Rai saw it as a way to help her siblings and as a way out for her.
In my village, girls weren't a priority. But the Maoists always talked about equality, which was something I wanted in my own life. So I left my education and joined them because I thought I could become something through the training. And I did end up learning many new skills.
Like how to shoot assault weapons. She also became a black belt in karate and excelled at running. Rai told her mother when she left that she'd be gone for a week. It was more like 2 years. Her father and uncles searched for her. Her mother even tried to commit suicide.
When I remember that moment, I feel like crying. It's very difficult. I never wanted my mother to go through that because of me.
When the armed conflict ended in 2006 under a UN-brokered peace agreement, Rai was 17. She thought she'd continue as a soldier in the Nepali army, but she was considered too young. So she returned to her village, devastated. She stayed in touch, though, with her karate instructor from the Maoist camp and focused on keeping herself physically fit. He eventually invited her to live with his family in Kathmandu. Every morning at 6, she stretches and practices at his dojo. She calls her karate instructor her guru and says he pushes and inspires her. A few miles away, a group of Nepali girls say the same thing about Mira Rai.
Actually, we are inspired from Mira Rai. She looks like a boy, but yeah, she has good skills.
She looks like a boy.
Yeah, and talks like a boy.
This is the Himalayan Children's Home. The girls here take turns telling me why they like running and what Mira Rai told them the day she visited their running club.
She said, never give up. And she told us that running is also good for our health.
I asked the running club if it's easy to do sports as a girl in Nepal. They all shake their heads no.
Whereas a concept that girl cannot play anything, football, basketball, sports things. The things that girls are very weak to do.
Our Nepali society doesn't accept girl to be sportsman.
That girls can also do something in life.
Mira is happy to encourage these girls, though she knows sports alone won't change things in Nepal's conservative society, especially in the rural areas.
We're considered backward just because we're women, but we're not backward. We should be involved in sports, and we should make our country known for that.
Unfortunately, Nepal's government has barely acknowledged Rai's success and doesn't see mountain racing as a sport.
It's sad that everybody says mountain racing is a sport, but in my own country, the government doesn't recognize it.
But Rai isn't giving up.
I want to transfer the chance I got to my little sisters in Nepal. I want to help them learn what I learned and reach where I am today. I want them to have as big a name as mine someday.
For the World, Anne Bailey, Kathmandu, Nepal.
You can watch the trailer to that documentary about Meera Rai. That's at PRI.org. And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bell Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.